Dr. William Luther Pierce, 1998. Jews and the White Slave Trade.
Hello. Steven Spielberg's pseudo-historical film about a 19th century mutiny and massacre aboard a Spanish slave ship, Amistad, and the subsequent trial of the black mutineers is being praised by the reviewers. Spielberg, one of the wealthiest and most successful of Hollywood's Jewish filmmakers, also is being praised by his kinsmen in various so-called human rights organizations for using his propaganda skills to sensitize white Gentile audiences to the horrors of slavery and make them feel just a little more guilty for treating non-whites so badly in the past. What Spielberg's new film doesn't mention, of course, is that Spielberg's Jewish kinsmen owned many, though not all, of the ships involved in the 18th and 19th century Atlantic trade in black slaves, and, in fact, played a very prominent role in bringing black slaves to America. The film rather tends to steer one away from blaming anyone for slavery except white Gentiles. This bit of misdirection is interesting in light of the fact that Jews have been dominant in the slave trade since at least Roman times, especially the trade in white slaves. Jewish slave dealers followed Caesar's armies everywhere, into Gaul, into Germany, and into other northern lands, eager to buy as slaves all of the captives of the Romans, especially the female captives. Jews have remained dominant in the white slave trade until the present day, although during the Middle Ages the Christian Church tried unsuccessfully a number of times to stop them, beginning in the 5th century with an edict by the Emperor Theodosius II against Jews owning Christian slaves. After being banned from owning or dealing in slaves by one emperor, the Jews would wait until the next emperor came along, then they would buy a charter, giving them a monopoly in the slave trade. Then public outrage against the Jews would grow until another emperor would ban their slave dealing again. Most of the time, however, the Jews were the undisputed masters of the white slave trade, and that is still the case today. Interestingly enough, this fact was revealed in a recent news report in the Jewish newspaper, the New York Times, of all places. The January 11th issue has a major article titled "Contraband Women" and written by a Jewish reporter in Israel. The article deals specifically with the Jewish trade in Ukrainian and Russian women, although it doesn't label the trade as Jewish. What the report does say is this, and I quote, "Centered in Moscow and the Ukrainian capital Kiev, the networks trafficking women run east to Japan and Thailand, where thousands of young Slavic women now work against their will as prostitutes, and west to the Adriatic coast and beyond. The routes are controlled by Russian crime gangs based in Moscow." End of quote. What the reader must understand is that these crime gangs don't have a real Russian in them. They are entirely Jewish, but the agreed-upon subterfuge used by the newspapers in this country is to refer to them as Russian rather than as Jewish. Thus one reads in various news organs about the recent takeover of organized crime in many areas of America, especially the East Coast and Los Angeles, by Russian gangs, and of the viciousness and cleverness of these Russian gangsters. But there is never any mention of the fact that they are not Russians at all, but Jews from the former Soviet Union. Jews like Mr. Clinton's supporter, Vadim Rabinovich, photographed shaking hands with Clinton at a Miami fundraiser when he was illegally in the United States, as I mentioned in my broadcast of December 27th. The story of the exploitation of Eastern Europe by the Jews is a fascinating and infuriating story. Throughout the Middle Ages and into the modern era, they focused on profiting from the weaknesses and vices of the Gentile populations of Poles, Russians, Ukrainians, and others, among whom they lived as a barely tolerated minority. In addition to being the moneylenders, they controlled the liquor business and owned the drinking establishments, the gambling dens, and the brothels. A number of 19th century Russian writers, among them Dostoevsky and Gogol, have described their destructive effects on Slavic peasant society and the perpetual condition of mutual hostility which existed between the Jews and the Slavs. During the 19th and early 20th centuries, the Jewish trade in white slaves from these lands expanded enormously. It has been described by the Jewish historian Edward Bristow in his 1982 book, Prostitution and Prejudice, published by Oxford University Press and by Schocken Books in New York. Although Bristow's book is written from the viewpoint of one opposed to this Jewish trade in women, it is nevertheless enormously revealing. The Jews recruited peasant girls in Polish and Russian villages, usually under false pretenses, and transported them to brothels in Turkey, Egypt, and other parts of the Middle East, to Vienna, Budapest, and other major cities in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and as far away as New York, New Orleans, and Buenos Aires. This Jewish trade in Slavic women naturally caused a great deal of hatred against the Jews by the Slavs, and this hatred broke out in pogroms and other popular actions against the Jews over and over again. One would believe from the works of Mr. Spielberg and other Jewish propagandists that the hatred the Slavs bore against the Jews was based only on religious bigotry, and that the Jews were completely innocent and inoffensive. One fascinating fact which Bristow's book reveals is that the center of the Jewish trade in Polish girls was a little town called Oswiecim. The German name for this town was Auschwitz. I don't mean to imply that the Jews were the only ones at fault in the white slave trade. Gentile politicians and police officials gladly accepted bribes from the Jews and in return allowed them to carry on their dirty business. And in the United States, non-Jewish criminal elements, such as the Mafia, collaborated with the Jews or even ran their own white slave operations. But the trade in white slaves from Eastern Europe has been an exclusively Jewish activity for the last 200 years. It is ironic that another Jewish enterprise, organized Marxism, put a temporary crimp in the Jewish trade in Slavic women. When the Jewish Bolsheviks seized control of Russia and Ukraine after the First World War, and of Poland and other Slavic lands after the Second World War, they clamped down on all capitalist activity, including that of their Jewish brethren in the white slave business. What they did instead was establish a huge empire of slave labor camps, of which Alexander Solzhenitsyn has written so eloquently. Jewish slave dealers became commissars and slave camp bosses, and of course They butchered their Gentile opponents by the millions. The time of communism was the Jews' time for getting rid of all the Russian and Ukrainian patriots who had hated them for so long. Actually, some capitalist activity did survive throughout the communist years in the form of organized crime. Two excellent books on the subject were published in the United States, both written by Soviet Jews thoroughly familiar with organized crime in the Soviet Union. In fact, one of the authors, Yuri Brokhin, was a former member of a Jewish organized crime gang in Russia, where he worked as a pimp. His book, Hustling on Gorky Street, was published in 1975 by Dial Press in New York. The other author, Konstantin Simis, was a Jewish defense lawyer for organized Jewish criminals. His book, USSR, The Corrupt Society, was published in 1982 by Simon & Schuster. Both of these Jewish authors quite frankly write about the Jewish domination of organized crime during the communist years. Brokhin brags about it, in fact. He says Russians and other Slavs can only be ordinary criminals, depending on guns and strong-arm tactics, but they aren't smart enough for successful large-scale organized crime. Only Jews are smart enough for that. A factor neither author mentions, which was more important than smartness, was the connections Jewish criminals had with Jewish communists in the Soviet bureaucracy. When Abe, who ran a prostitution and drug racket in Moscow, could count on his cousin Jaime in the prosecutor's office to keep him informed about police plans for raids, as well as a little covert assistance if matters ever came to court, he had a distinct advantage over his Russian competitors. Eventually, communism bled Eastern Europe dry, and with the economies of the countries under their control on the verge of collapse, the communists switched hats, declared themselves Democrats instead of communists, and announced a return to capitalism. The Jewish slave dealers went back into business, and business was good for them. Other Jewish communists went into business too. As the economies were privatized, that is, as state-owned factories and businesses were sold to private entrepreneurs at bargain basement prices, Jews used their connections with their now democratic kinsmen in the bureaucracies to snap them up. Other Jews who had monopolized organized crime during the communist years remained as organized crime bosses, but greatly expanded the scope of their operations. Often, the new entrepreneurs and the new crime bosses have been the same people. The richest man in Russia today is Boris Berezovsky, who, since the collapse of communism, has become a multi-billionaire by buying up banks, utilities, television networks, and newspapers from the government, with the aid of his fellow Jews still in the bureaucracy. Berezovsky speeds around Moscow in a bulletproof vest and an armored limousine, and anyone who gets in the way of his business interests has a tendency to get shot or simply to disappear. Second only to Berezovsky in wealth is another Jewish media mogul, Vladimir Gusinsky. Between them, Berezovsky and Gusinsky control most of the mass media in Russia. They also exercise pretty thorough control of Boris Yeltsin, Russia's alcoholic president, who is sort of a Slavic version of Bill Clinton plus vodka. It was only through the support of Berezovsky's and Gusinsky's media that Yeltsin won his last election. If you remember, Clinton and all of the Jewish media in the United States also were rooting enthusiastically for Yeltsin during that election. They all were afraid that a genuine Russian patriot might beat Yeltsin, in which case the Jewish control of Russia would have been finished. After the election, Yeltsin appointed Berezovsky to Russia's National Security Council. But when some of the few media in Russia, which still are independent, publicized Berezovsky's connections to Jewish organized crime gangs, Yeltsin was forced to fire him. Yeltsin has made up for that, however, by appointing another Jew, Boris Nemtsov, to the position of Deputy Prime Minister, one of the most powerful positions in the government. One thing Yeltsin never has done, however, is make any move to curtail the operations of Russia's organized Jewish crime gangs, which are running rampant through the country and displaying their wealth and power, while ordinary Russians struggle to feed themselves and keep their homes warm this winter. And tens of thousands of pretty but naive young Russian and Ukrainian women are being swept up by the Jewish gangs, called Russian gangs by the New York Times, and shipped off to a life of misery and degradation in Turkey, Pakistan, Thailand, and Israel, as well as to countries in Western Europe where Jews also control organized crime. The young women, unable to find work in Russia or Ukraine or Poland, and facing a bleak future in countries ravaged by decades of communism, are eager for any chance at a better life. They respond to advertisements that offer them work abroad as receptionists or secretaries, and also promise free training and transportation. When the girls arrive at their destinations, however, they find something quite different. But by then, it is too late. One of these girls, Irina, a 21-year-old, green-eyed Ukrainian blonde, was interviewed in Israel. She told how her Israeli employer took her to a brothel soon after her arrival in Israel. He took her passport away from her, burned it before her eyes, and told her that she now was his property and must work in the brothel. When Irina refused, she was beaten and raped. Luckier than most of the Slavic women lured to Israel, Irina eventually was swept up in a police raid and sent to prison as an illegal alien. She was awaiting deportation along with hundreds of other Russian and Ukrainian women when she was interviewed. She lamented the fact that the Israeli who had raped her and forced her to work in the brothel was not even arrested. Indeed, according to Jewish law, the rape of a Gentile woman is not illegal. Nor is it illegal in Israel to buy and sell slaves, so long as the slaves are not Jewish. Amazingly, the New York Times article reveals this fact. The white slave trade is big business in Israel. Ukrainian authorities estimate that as many as 40,000 Ukrainian women under the age of 30 are taken from Ukraine each year. Some of these women respond to advertisements promising employment abroad, like Irina did, and some are simply kidnapped and smuggled out of the country. Those who try to escape from their Jewish captors are treated brutally. Often they are butchered in front of other captive women to keep the others terrified into doing whatever they are told. At slave markets operated by the Jewish gangs in Italy, young Slavic women are stripped, put on blocks, and auctioned off to brothel owners. The most astounding thing about this whole filthy business is that most people are forced to learn about it from a Jewish newspaper like the New York Times. And really, you should read for yourself the article to which I referred. It was in the January 11th issue, and the news is not likely to be repeated. But ask yourself, why doesn't Interpol, the international police agency, do something to put a stop to this white slave trade? Why don't the governments of the countries from which the women are being abducted do something? Why don't the mass media raise a hue and cry? Why don't powerful feminist organizations demand the eradication of white slavery? The answer to all of these questions is easy. They dare not do or say anything because it is a Jewish business. In places like Germany, where the Jews have almost total control of organized crime, anyone who announces that fact publicly will be arrested and charged with inciting racial hatred. Germany and most other European countries have laws against what they call hate speech. Saying anything negative about Jews, true or not, invokes these laws. Jewish organizations, and of course the Clinton administration, would like very much to have similar laws in the United States. Interpol, which has plenty of other work to keep it busy, is not eager to be charged with anti-Semitism by going after the Jewish white slave gangs. Even if Interpol did arrest the gangsters, it wouldn't do much good because the fix is in nearly everywhere. There's a huge amount of money made from selling women. Enough money to pay off politicians, bureaucrats, judges, and policemen. Jews like to say about the so-called Holocaust of the Second World War, never again. They like to talk about how it is necessary to stamp out anti-Semitism and pass new laws against so-called hate speech so that there can never be another Holocaust. But by their own behavior, they guarantee that there will be. While some Jews beat the drums for more reparations payments from Switzerland, Germany, France, and other countries they claim didn't treat them right or took some of their ill-gotten gold from them 55 or 60 years ago, other Jews are still bleeding countries like Poland, Ukraine, Russia, and the Baltic nations of money and of their young women. Countries which suffered for decades under the brutal rule of communist commissars are still being exploited by the same people now calling themselves Democrats. The Jews believe that with their death grip on the mass media nearly everywhere, with their puppets like Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin in positions of power in the East and in the West, with the enormous wealth they have at their disposal, and with so many Gentiles buffaloed by Holocaust propaganda of the sort cranked out by Steven Spielberg and 100 others, they can keep getting away with their exploitation of us forever. But they are wrong. They themselves are building up the hatred and the resentment and the rage which will destroy them all, the gang members, the media bosses, the advisors to Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin, the professional Holocaust wailers, the former commissars, and all the rest, even those who are not currently involved in any of these activities. They are guaranteeing that there will be another Holocaust, and this time it will be a real one. Thanks for being with me again today, and do find and read that article on the white slave trade in the January 11th New York Times.